This is Living Planet. I'm Kathleen Schuster. We're bringing you something a little different today. You're about to hear an episode from a really great podcast called Up From Dust, which is produced by the NPR stations of Kansas. And rather than me telling you what it's about, I've invited their creator and host to tell you herself. Her name is Celia Yopis Jepson. Celia, welcome to Living Planet.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here.
Well, one thing I want to say right up front is that when I heard the name of this podcast, I was like, ah, yes, Kansas dust. I love it.
You're thinking the Dust Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. It really evokes that image because I think, you know, for those of us who aren't from Kansas, it generally tends to be the Dust Bowl or, I'm really sorry, but the Wizard of Oz and Dorothy. So
a very Dust Bowl image of Kansas.
Yeah, exactly. But tell us a little bit about where that name comes from and, yeah, what this podcast is about.
Yeah. So a century ago, basically what happened was we had plowed up so much prairie. We had left the soil basically just totally vulnerable to the elements. And then when that combined with wind and heat that was just brutal, what you had was massive dust storms. And by the end of the Dust Bowl, thousands of people had died. It would be impossible, I think, to even guess how many animals died in the Dust Bowl. It took a long time to recover from that. Our podcast is not just about the Dust Bowl. We do reference that catastrophe multiple times, but we're looking at how we continue to struggle with environmental issues in the center of North America related to agriculture, related to the sustainability of our cities. And, you know, we meet people who are rolling up their sleeves, who are looking for ways to do these things, growing our food, et cetera, in a more sustainable way.
And I find that really interesting, too, like kind of starting from that place of like the Dust Bowl, because I think for a long time, like when we learned about it in history class for listeners who are from the States, it wasn't really called an environmental crisis. It was just something that kind of happened in the 30s that also sparked like mass migration westward, kind of famously portrayed in The Grapes of Wrath. And now, of course, being environmental reporters, we're looking at everything to kind of piece together a history of like how we got to where we are, right?
So the idea behind the podcast is we, as humans, shape our surroundings to what fits our needs, to how we want to grow our food, et cetera. We make the world more convenient for ourselves. But there are times when this backfires massively, and the Dust Bowl is a very obvious, prominent symbol of that. We continue to deal with ways that we've kind of gone too far. And we're looking at how do we rein that in? How do we continue to feed ourselves and build our cities, but do so in a way that's going to work better for us long term?
So there's a lot in this podcast that's not just for people native to Kansas.
Yes. Kansas is a great place to understand what's happening in the whole kind of center of North America. I'm just going to put out a shout out here for prairies. If you have never seen a prairie is an incredible place. In Kansas, we have the biggest swath of tall grass prairie left on the planet. It is a very endangered ecosystem. You know, prairie used to cover a third of this continent. So when you listen to our podcast, you're learning about how the landscapes have changed in a huge part of North America because of human activities, why those changes affect us, how they affect us, and what comes next.
Yeah. And it's also, I think that's so cool to also have this perspective from like literally the center of the U.S. because a lot of times, you know, the reporting is very much focused on the coasts or, you know, like a lot of American reporting tends to come from like New York, DC area. And so I thought that's something that I also found just really interesting.
You know, we decided we needed to explore for those of us who aren't living maybe next to a coast where people are, you know, worried about hurricanes and other things related to climate change, you know, hurricanes getting worse and such. What does climate change mean for those of us who are living a lot more inland on this continent? And that's what we explore. We explore how wildfires are changing and the ways that human activities beyond climate change are feeding into that. Because it, you know, climate change is part of the puzzle, but there's a lot more about how we live on the land here that is putting us at greater risk for wildfires and other problems.
Celia, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Celia Yopis Jepson is the creator and host of the podcast Up From Dust. Here's an episode.
So, David, I got to visit a very special prairie last summer.
Yep, it's a monarch.
Loads of flowers.
Prairie flocks.
Never, ever been farmed. This kind of landscape is rare.
Prairie violet. This is the food source for the regal fritillary, a rare butterfly, and they're on this prairie.
So, a really beautiful place, but also kind of scary.
How can a prairie be scary?
See, I kind of lied when I said it's never, ever been farmed. Half of it hasn't. The other half was farmed for like 70 or 80 years. Then the University of Kansas acquired it and planted it back to native grasses. So it's part of the KU Field Station now, where biologists and students do research. Oh, speaking of KU, that's Kelly Kincher.
Senior scientist at the Kansas Biological Survey and a professor in environmental studies.
Okay, the scary part. If you wade through the grasses and the wildflowers on this prairie to the exact dividing line between the half that was once crops and the half that never was...
Look at this. You can just see there's that just drop off.
You find an elevation change.
It looks like 6 to 8 feet here.
Cutting right through the middle of the field.
Huge. Huge.
And David, can you guess what that slope is doing there?
I'm guessing it has to do with soil loss?
Massive topsoil loss. And the reason for that is...
Plowing?
Yeah, it's plowing.
Yeah, a lot of plowing over a lot of years. I think I've seen something like this before when I was out reporting in western Kansas.
Where have you seen it before?
So south of Hayes, along a fence between a field and a pasture, and there was this slope. I mean, it looks like it was, you know, engineered.
When you see the sheer volume of soil that's not there anymore, it just kind of freaks you out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got someone like Kelly with you to point things out, you realize you're not just looking at an elevation change. The plant species suddenly changed when we hit that slope. The never farmed side is, to be frank, it's just plain cooler, right? It's got so many more wildflowers, including threatened species.
Meets milkweed and the prairie-fringed orchid.
Prairie-fringed orchid?
Yes.
I have never even heard of this flower, Celia.
They are frilly and fabulous. These orchids disappear for years at a time, poof, and then they just show up again. So, you know, lots of cool flowers here, but it's like all these wildflowers just don't seem to like the recovering half of the prairie all that much.
And there's probably about 20 to 30 species that just haven't crossed this line. They just don't move across with nothing preventing it. I mean, we know we're getting seeds across there.
Wow. They just don't grow once they get into that soil because it's so damaged.
Right. Even though it's been 60 years since it was plowed, you stand on that slope and you can kind of swivel back and forth and compare what you're seeing on each side.
The greenness just drops off.
It's like paler and it's...
Yeah, yellower.
Wait, so there's like an actual color difference?
Yeah, the plants on that plowed half are almost like a kind of jaundiced version of themselves. But the implications are not just for the things living here on this research field. I mean, you witnessed this same phenomenon on a farm.
Like, I knew, you know, soil loss was a thing, but I had never thought about that until I stood at that place.
There are stakes here for our crop production, for our reliance on chemical fertilizer, and so much more. But if we can farm in ways that make our soils healthier again, David, then it's going to pay off. And a lot of farmers are doing just that. From the Kansas News Service and KCUR Studios, you're listening to Up From Dust, a podcast about the environmental price of trying to shape the world around us.
And the folks who are rolling up their sleeves to find less damaging, more sustainable ways to fix our generational mistakes. I'm David Kondos.
And I'm Celia Yopis Jepson. Here in the Midwest and on the Great Plains, our states are agriculture powerhouses, and people here have plowed the land for generations to grow our food, our economy.
But we've been turning rich soil, full of life that we depend on, into a shadow of its former self. And that makes it harder to grow food and harder to fight climate change.
efforts to farm without plowing are tricky, but have never been more important. And there's a lot of reasons for hope here. Momentum is growing toward a plow-free future that can help us prepare for and respond to climate change, and that can help us start to fix some of the damage that we've already done.
Okay, so Celia, all across the Midwest and the Great Plains, this ground has shifted beneath our feet. Do we know how much soil we have lost from all this plowing?
In 2022, some scientists at the University of Massachusetts put out a study, and their conclusion was that the Midwest alone, David, has lost nearly 60 billion metric tons of soil since large-scale plowing came to the region. We are losing soil so much faster than new soil forms to replace it. And that is just not a tenable way of doing things.
How did we get here?
This is a crisis that unfolded over the last century and a half. Basically, after Europeans colonized America, they brought a very different relationship to the land than Native Americans, and Europeans and their descendants plowed their way across the continent seeking prosperity through farming. And this freed huge amounts of soil to start moving. It had been held in place by roots, in our region, mostly prairie roots that are deep and dense and knit super tight together. I mean, they hold soil, like the shortgrass prairie.
That sod's so tough. We had sod houses, even two-story houses have sod. They would flip over, particularly buffalo grass, blue grama, and just stack it up.
That's Kelly Kinscher from KU again. It was not easy for settlers to break that stuff up and start farming it.
You needed something really, really powerful. So the last, you know, breaking of the western Kansas shortgrass prairie was the big boom in the 19-teens when they had steam-powered tractors that could bust tens of thousands of acres.
And so people plowed and plowed and plowed to make a living, to feed themselves, and they left lots of bare soil with rows of annual crops that, compared to a prairie, barely held anything in place. So the soil just slid away. It washed away. It literally blew away.
And of course, the most infamous example of this is the Dust Bowl.
Nobody can tell it any worse than what it was. It was that bad.
If you haven't seen the Ken Burns documentary about it, you should definitely check it out.
It'd blister your face. It would put your eyes out.
Kelly says it was probably the most horrendous loss of soil the Great Plains had ever seen. It left farms barren and ravaged, western Kansas, Oklahoma Panhandle, Texas Panhandle.
It was predicted that many, many of those areas were going to be ruined forever, would not return to agriculture. But World War II brought on commercial fertilizer, and lots of those lands that were damaged responded well to commercial fertilizers.
The U.S. chemical fertilizer industry is, in many ways, a byproduct of World War II.
Hundreds of planes provided air cover for the seaborne invasion below.
During the war, we were making lots of explosives. Then, after the war ended,
President Truman announced the official surrender.
It was super easy for factories to toggle from churning out nitrogen for explosives to making nitrogen fertilizer for farm fields. But Kelly says this fertilizer that we lean on so much nowadays is kind of misleading because it's been masking the poor health of the soil for decades now and how much of the soil we're still losing.
So we're still seeing really highly productive land, even though we know that we're losing the best part of that soil still through erosion.
But there's a better way.
Exactly.
David, we're going to need an unapologetically enthusiastic soil nerd to guide us on some science. Chuck Rice, and he is a soil microbiologist at Kansas State University in Manhattan.
Manhattan, Kansas. We like to call it the Little Apple.
So I asked Chuck to show me some of his dirt samples in his lab. And this means that I immediately broke his number one rule.
Don't say dirt.
Do not say dirt.
For a soil scientist, dirt is a dirty word. Dirt has a negative connotation. Soil sounds a lot better.
You feel like dirt gets a bad rap.
Yes. I do. Which and I don't want soil to get a bad rap. It's the stuff of life. I mean, we grow our food on it. In a tablespoon of this soil, there would be a billion microbes. Penicillin, streptomycin, all those antibiotics, most of them came from soil.
I have a lot more respect for soil right now.
So it's not dirt.
So Chuck was kind enough to get out some of his soil samples.
From three different fields.
Soil from a tilled crop field.
So what do you see?
Pretty pale.
Soil from a field where crops are grown without tilling.
It's just a few shades darker. Mm-hmm.
And soil from a healthy prairie.
Like a brown-black color.
Almost black.
All right, remember the prairie in Lawrence. Remember how the wildflowers growing in the, like, sad, formerly plowed soil were more faded in color? Well, the soil itself is literally the same story. The plowed stuff is faded.
At one time, this soil was like the prairie. But then 150 years ago, we came in and plowed up the prairie to grow wheat, corn, soybeans, and our crops.
Okay. Let's see. We've got three petri dishes. You're getting a little bit of this tilled dirt into a petri dish.
Don't say dirt.
Oh, no. I broke the rule.
I'm going to wet it up here.
Okay, so now...
So what do you see? What happens?
The one on the left with the tilled dirt is just... Soil. So the tilled soil, it totally dissolved, and now the water is a murky mess.
Right. Can you imagine when the rain hits this field?
A whole bunch of it just maybe washes away?
Yeah, it's going to run downstream from Manhattan to Lawrence to Kansas City.
Okay, but what about the other two petri dishes? The farm soil that hadn't been plowed and the prairie soil?
So instead of just like a dish full of mud, it was like clear water with clumps of soil just resting in it, right? Good soil stays clumpy and resists erosion even in a downpour of rain because of all that lovely organic matter in it, which is what you can literally see in the color difference.
Basically, the darker it is, the more organic matter. And more carbon means more food for the microbes.
Organic matter is like our secret sauce for happy, healthy soil. Fighting erosion is just one of the benefits of it. There are lots of them, and David, they are a really good reason that we should all care about all those tiny things living below the surface. Okay, I'm going to take you into the ground for a minute, David.
All right.
There is a whole world of microscopic critters down there. I picture a Brazilian rainforest, right? It's full of life. There's, I don't know, you know, monkeys swinging through the trees, and there's like toucans and just all these like amazing things, right? Think of soil as this miniature Brazilian rainforest. There's a lot going on down there. I've been fantasizing, like, what if we could, like, shrink down David Attenborough and send him into the soil with a teeny tiny camera crew to make a documentary for us?
Now watch as the protozoa rushes straight into the herd of bacteria.
Is that your David Attenborough impression?
I'm trying here.
The point is, there are herbivores, there are predators down there, there are microbes breaking down the dead leaves and the roots, you know, like last year's corn roots or the leaf litter from your oak tree or whatever. And you've got all these nutrients that are just there for the taking. This is like an all-you-can-eat buffet for these little critters.
So this is like a teeny tiny circle of life.
Yeah, it's you end up with soil that's fluffy down there, porous and airy and packed with things that we want in there, like carbon and nitrogen. Let's start a list, David.
All right.
We're going to call this benefit number one of farming without tilling, a.k.a. no-till farming. As we learned in Chuck's lab, untilled ground withstands rain so much better. Also, wind.
It takes about 1,000 years to make 1 inch of soil. So if we lose 1 inch of soil, that's 1,000 years worth.
That's why a lot of people argue soil is not actually a renewable resource. It's more in that non-renewable category.
It's like this super precious thing.
Okay, number two on the list. Happier, healthier plants. Because if the soil life is undisturbed, that little Brazilian rainforest down there is doing its job. And so the plants...
They've got all these yummy nutrients to feed them. Kelly Kinchter showed you on the prairie. Like the luscious, greenest parts were the places that had never been tilled.
When KU scientists started really looking at that soil from the formerly plowed side of the prairie, they could see it's still missing so much itty-bitty life.
Mycorrhizae, all the soil microorganisms are gone or greatly depauperate. There's very few different species.
There's just less microscopic life in that soil?
Yes, yes. Yes.
And remember, that prairie hasn't been plowed for like 60 years or so now, and it's not healed yet. It's better, but it's not healed.
So longer term, I'm hopeful, but longer term, I'm not sure we'll get everything back. I really wonder if we truly can restore the prairie.
Like, I think of that rhyme, the, you know, like all the king's horses and all the king's men.
Humpty Dumpty? You're trying to put together the prairie, and it's still the... It's not happening. It's not working.
Like, it turns out, it's really not that simple. Especially one kind of soil dweller that scientists have realized is really important. You heard Kelly use the word.
Mycorrhizae.
Mycorrhizae. Basically, a partnership between very cool fungi and plants that helps plants unlock nutrients in the soil. So this is a really silly comparison, but you know those Capri Sun pouches? You punch the dang straw into them?
Yeah, I mean, I've done those for my kids all the time.
I've been thinking of the soil kind of like that. It's full of this delicious stuff that you can't get to easily if you're a plant. And these fungi are the straw. They punch open the Capri Sun so that plant roots can take a long drink of things like phosphorus.
So these Capri Sun straws are gone, and now the... plants are trying to drink their Capri Sun with no straw.
One of the goals of not tilling is to let these mycorrhizae start healing and thriving again. And you can combine this with other practices that boost soil health in the end, like planting cover crops that pull nitrogen out of the air and pack it into the soil. For the farmer, good soil life can mean ultimately spending less money putting a Band-Aid on ailing soil. Here's Chuck again from K-State.
He or she does not have to put on more fertilizer.
Using less fertilizer is also just better for the environment.
We're going to add that to the list too. So now that's number three.
We use fossil fuels to make nitrogen fertilizer.
Plus, there's famously a huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico now where hardly any marine life can live. And one of the big reasons for it is all the fertilizer that's washing off of fields and eventually down the rivers and into the Gulf of Mexico. Number four, no-till farming will help our crops handle climate change.
Global warming, climate change is shifting climate patterns. And so a lot of Kansas and the Midwest will likely see more of these really dry spells and then more really heavy rain.
So Chuck took me outdoors to see a long-running experiment and learn how no-till helps in drought and downpours. Simple concept, 2 acres of crops.
The corn's just starting to come up.
One half tilled, the other not.
We're standing on the dividing line.
Chuck brought 2 pieces of metal stovepipe.
It's like a 6-inch diameter.
Yeah.
Container they're shoving into the dirt here.
What dirt?
Oh man, I did it again.
He pushes 1 stovepipe into the tilled soil, the second one into untilled soil, pours in water, and the soil that had been plowed over and over again, it struggles to take the water in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not porous. The surface is just like a dusty, crusty.
I've definitely seen that crust. The water would just run off.
Yep, into ditches or just evaporate. Now, the stovepipe in the untilled soil.
It's soaked in?
Nearly twice as fast.
That no-till soil is going to be more resilient.
Remember, when we don't disturb the soil so often, we can restore it to something more airy and porous. In torrential downpours, it can soak up more water to help against flooding. In dry spells, that soil can hold onto the moisture better, so plants can hold out longer. Okay, last benefit that we'll cover.
How many benefits are we up to now?
5. And number 5 is a pretty damn good one.
Okay.
Pulling carbon out of the atmosphere.
All right, so this is coming right back to climate change.
When you till the earth, you release loads of carbon that was stored in the ground. Chuck says, on average, we've lost 50% of the carbon that was stored in U.S. soil. but we can make a bunch of changes to farming.
Like no-till, cover crops.
To pack that carbon back into the ground.
And that's good.
This is actually Chuck's wheelhouse. Big reveal here. He was a lead author on the agriculture section of a super important 2007 International Climate Change Report, a major international effort that won a Nobel Peace Prize.
Chuck won a Nobel Prize? Wow.
Which is why we should all listen to him when he says we should say soil instead of dirt. So, going back to that 2-acre plot of corn that Chuck showed me.
This was only supposed to be a 3-year experiment.
Whoops.
And now, foolishly, I can't stop it because after 30, 35 years of no-till, we're finding some unique things out here that nobody else has seen.
First, carbon began packing into the top 2 inches of no-till soil. Then carbon started packing in deeper down, 3 inches deep, 4, 5, 6 inches deep.
Now, the last couple of years, we're starting to see carbon build up in that 6 to 12 inch layer. So the question is, you know, how much carbon can the soil hold?
I want to be clear, K-State didn't invent good farming. There are peoples around the world who have done all sorts of sustainable farming techniques for a really long time. This no-till stuff and a whole suite of kind of interrelated approaches are starting to become mainstream.
How common is no-till?
So according to the USDA, just asking farmers, 38% of U.S. farmland was apparently no-till as of 2022. And we're not including the types of farms that you wouldn't till anyway, like an apple orchard. That's not really relevant.
But Celia, you know, if we have all these benefits, we've listed financial benefits, soil benefits, climate benefits, I think we need to talk about why every farmer hasn't made the switch to no-till.
So I asked Chuck.
So excellent question.
Making the switch to no-till, it's rough. A lot of farmers who try it really struggle.
There's reduced yield for the first 3 or 4 years when they're implementing no-till.
Sometimes people give up because no-till requires learning all sorts of new tricks. Like if your soil is compacted, how do you fix that without a plow? Okay, so you have to learn about specific cover crops to help.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious learning curve, and they're doing it with their livelihood that already takes a lot of time and money.
This is why you can find a lot of news stories and opinion pieces about how the Federal Farm Bill works and whether it's time to overhaul it, really push for soil-friendly farming. But back to Chuck.
Once farmers are into it, 6, 7 years,
they break through.
They will sell their equipment. They don't want to till. The no-till really takes off.
But we got to acknowledge there are downsides, too. I mean, there's this link between no-till farming and herbicide. And herbicides are another kind of pollution.
Yes, because you still need a way to kill weeds after you give up plowing. And plowing kills weeds. And yes, herbicides lead to pollution. And Roundup, for example, the name that people usually know for the most common herbicide in the U.S., glyphosate, it's played a key role in the increase in no-till acres. But the International Agency for Research on Cancer says glyphosate probably causes cancer.
Yeah, and that's an important point that, you know, farming with no-till doesn't necessarily mean it's organic.
And just because a farm is organic, that doesn't mean they don't regularly till. There are no-till farmers, or increasingly those who use the term regenerative ag, cutting down on their use of ag chemicals. And there are organic farmers cutting down a lot on tilling. So, David, and of course, our fantastic listeners, you made it through all that soil science. Let's get back outside for a field trip. I found a farm outside Lawrence that has successfully ditched plowing and agriculture chemicals. But the work there is very hands-on and at a small scale that makes that possible.
My name is Pantaleon Flores. Yeah, I run Masewal Quali Farms.
Masawa Kuali means the people's farm in Nahuatl, an indigenous language from central Mexico, and this is a micro farm.
There's two kinds of hops in the back, three different mints.
So he grows specialties.
Korean flatleaf chives, red gooseberry, that's Mexican tarragon.
Aims for variety and ingredients to tempt local ice cream shops, restaurants, winemakers to buy.
Rhubarb.
Growing really close to strawberries. You know, the pie combination is, they're even grown next to each other.
Now all you need here is a cow so you can get some fresh cream.
He mixes up his plantings, rotates certain things year to year.
So if you continuously plant the same thing in the same spot, you have a very high likelihood of also cultivating the pathogens that like to take it down.
So you're helping the health of your plants through the element of surprise. Nature doesn't know what will grow there next.
Kind of. I'd like to think so.
So Pantaleon's been running his fruit and veggie business since 2018, doing everything by hand, trying to nurture the soil, the insects, the plants.
Yeah, even on a really small farm, like that is a ton of work.
So does that at all translate into better prices if you like go and sell to a restaurant or something?
I wish. not usually, no. I don't really blame him for that either, because the restaurant industry has one of the worst margins of any industry, just like this kind of farming does. They got to eat and pay bills too.
Yeah, so it sounds like the sale price of these fruits and vegetables isn't a motivation for farmers to save soil on its own.
Right, and that remains a challenge for all farmers that are trying to take steps to do things in a more environmentally friendly way. But Pantaleon clearly believes this is the way to grow food responsibly. He uses all kinds of tricks to feed the soil life, to stay on top of weeds, because remember, he steers clear of herbicides.
This right here is a winter rye.
Yeah, that's winter rye for the watermelon patch that will be there. I try to leave the soil unexposed for as long as possible to prevent erosion mainly. So it's food, it's moisture retention, it's erosion prevention. It was like a little winter blanket for it, yeah.
So I mentioned that Pantaleon doesn't plow. Actually, he points out that he just can't. I mean, he can't afford that kind of equipment and farming. But he also worries about causing too much damage to the ground that just won't work out for farmers and communities long term.
At the end of the day, it's really killing off a lot of the life in the soil that is the symbiotic relationship of the plants and the soil. And you're kind of hitting a reset for the life in the soil every time you till.
You want lots of life in the soil. You're greedy about life in your soil.
Yes, I'm very greedy about giving things as much life as I can. Honestly, all agriculture is somewhat destructive. I mean, we are, as a species, consumers, right? So we are going to, in order to survive, consume things and destroy things.
But to him, that doesn't mean we can't try harder to take better care of the soil and ultimately to cut down our reliance on tilling, chemicals, fossil fuels, and try to make our food systems work well for us and the environment long term.
I know that there are ways that we can definitely reduce that, and that's what I'd kind of like to see more of.
This episode was brought to you by KCUR's Up From Dust podcast. It was written and reported by Celia Yopis-Jepson and produced by Mackenzie Martin. You can find episodes of Up From Dust wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Kathleen Schuster, and our sound engineers this week were Michael Springer and Jürgen Kuhn. Make sure to check out our podcast feed next week for a new episode of Living Planet. Living Planet is produced by DW in Bonn, Germany.